and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, the host of the program. We've got a real treat for you for today's program. We're finally doing our top 10 finds in biblical archaeology for 2025. What is customary for us in this program is that I bring on board Christopher Reams from Jerusalem, our Jerusalem office, and we're going to go back and forth from 10 all the way down to 1 with the top 10. I will say also that a lot of these discoveries have been reported on already in our magazine, Let the Stone Speak. If you don't have a copy of the magazine, or if you haven't requested your free subscription of our magazine, please go to armstronginstitute.org or write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and just say that you want to sign up for the free magazine, and we'll make sure that you are subscribed to that. Also, don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel to make sure you don't miss anything new from the world of biblical archaeology. Now I'm going to bring in Chris. Thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Brent. It's crazy. It's 2026. Here we are.
Yep, 2026, but we are going to live in the past for the next 30 or 40 minutes to go through these top 10 finds. These are discoveries that have been made and reported on. They are publications that have come out that are reanalyzing old excavations or old discoveries. Anything that has surfaced and is new or bringing new information to the world of biblical archaeology could be classified in our top 10 for 2025. So we're going to go kind of me, the new, all the way through the top 10. And if people want to jump ahead, they can look down below and see what's coming up. We won't hold you in suspense too much if you want to jump down further down the list. Okay, so no further ado, we're going to jump to top 10, and you'll be taking this, Chris.
All right, so this one is the discovery of a fortress in the northern Sinai. I want to start out with a Bible verse, actually. So a passage of scripture in the book of Exodus, chapter 13, verse 18 says that when the Israelites were leaving Egypt, God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. This is a more southern route rather than the most direct route out of Egypt and into the land of Canaan. So why was this the case? The prior verse explains that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war and they return to Egypt. So that's what the Bible says. Archaeology gives an interesting corroborative picture. We know that the northern route, which was alternately called the way of the land of the Philistines or the ways of Horus, this was a strongly fortified military route that led up into Canaan. There were several Egyptian fortresses along this route, and this year the discovery of another one was announced at Tel El Haruba. So this one has been called, I believe, something like the biggest Egyptian fortress to the east that has so far been discovered, the biggest defensive fortress. The area of this fortress is 8,000 square meters. Roughly, that's, I think, 85,000 square feet. Over 100, there was a wall that was found, the southern wall, which extended for a length of over 100 meters. It supported 11 towers on it. Huge, big fortress along this northern route. So you can get a good kind of picture of like illustrating what the biblical account is saying, that this is a direction in which you will see war if you take this route. God says he doesn't want the Israelites to see war. He'll take them instead through the southern route, lest peradventure they try and return back into Egypt. So this now becomes one of 11 known fortresses that continue along this route up into the land of Canaan. Really impressive fortress. Its construction is dated to around 1500 BCE. We're talking about the time of King Thutmose I, probably, so a little bit before then. roughly 3,500 years ago. So most likely it was built during the time of Thutmose the first. This is based on some foundation deposits that were found there. Now, if you take the Exodus position that I do, I'm an early Exodus proponent. This puts the Exodus around the 15th century BCE. So this puts the construction of this fortress just before then. And so this would make sense with the Israelites leaving about a century later. They would be passing through this area with this fully operational, fully functional fortress at this time period.
Great. Thank you. We're going to go to number 9 now. That's me. We'll be talking about King Josiah's last stand at Megiddo, at least evidence of it, an Egyptian presence at Megiddo. People will recall that during the time of Jeremiah the prophet, the very start of his work, King Josiah was in charge in Judah. The northern tribes of Israel had already gone into captivity. And this was a window of time where the Assyrian Empire was lacking strength. The rise of the Babylonians was coming into play, producing kind of this vacuum where Josiah could extend his territory, as the Bible brings out, into the territory that formerly belonged to the Israelites. And that's where Megiddo is located. And at this site, Megiddo, they finally did excavations that revealed a really unknown period of the Tell in the late 7th century. There's 26 occupation layers there at Megiddo. So you've got dates from the past 5 millennia there. It's incredible what they've found there. But nothing was found until these excavations in the past decade, and then reported just recently in the Scandinavian Journal about a discovery of a stratum and a building in Area X, as they call it, of the Tell that dates this time period of Josiah. And what it shows, and what was surprising, was that they found pottery, really mundane and boring pottery that wouldn't necessarily have been imported, but this pottery was native to the Nile region. So Egyptian pottery was found at Megiddo in the late 7th century. And if you remember your biblical chronology and history, this is exactly the same time that Josiah is traveling all the way up to Megiddo to block off the path of the Egyptian army under Pharaoh Necho as he's going up to assist the Assyrians against the Babylonians. And Josiah says, don't pass through here or whatever. Like Pharaoh Necho says, don't interfere. My fight's not with you. Josiah does. And he ends up being shot with an arrow, returning back to Jerusalem, and then dying. And this is a battle that takes place in the area of Megiddo. And now we have evidence that we have the Egyptian, potentially even Egyptian garrison, or Egyptians that were stationed there for a certain amount of time, indicating that this matches up really well with this very important event in Judah's history. Of course, after Josiah's death, that's when you had the Book of Lamentations being written, at least its initial draft, let's say, by Jeremiah the prophet, and then we knew that Judah was kind of on its way out, and it would eventually fall to the Babylonians. So I think in terms of Egyptian pottery, this is really rare. If you take all the evidence from other Levantine cities, or the cities from Phoenicia down to Judah, during this period, there's very few shards of Egyptian pottery, and they found three times the amount that's found anywhere else at this precise time when the Bible says Egypt should be present at this site. So pretty dramatic. They even found in this same building some Judean ware as well, made out of matzah clay, which is from the Jerusalem region, indicating again that there was some potential influence of Judah so far in the north. So Judah's, Josiah's last stand, evidence of that at Megiddo, is our number 9. Now back to you for number 8.
All right, number 8, we have the discovery of shipwreck cargoes from Dor, the area of Dor, Tel Dor. This is a port site along Israel's coast. So if you imagine the coast of Israel, you have Haifa toward the north, Tel Aviv toward the south, and Dor right in the center. Probably many of our viewers will be familiar with the kind of sweeping coastline of southern Israel. It's really interesting, like the geography there, why it is such a smooth line makes it terrible for forming natural ports. But as soon as you get up as far as Dor, you start to have a much more conducive area, lots of natural harbors there. And so this became a really important port site, port city, Dor, Tel Dor. There are 20 ancient shipwrecks off the coast there. And this year we had, within the August issue of Antiquity, a new announcement about the excavation of three of those shipwrecks. So this excavation took place over the course of 2023, 2024, and then, like I say, it was reported on this year. So three of these shipwrecks within the Iron Age period, the earliest of which dates to the 11th century BCE. This was dated to that period based on its cargo, based on the finds discovered within. And we know based on these remains that Dor at this time was being controlled by the Sikil people, this member of the Sea Peoples group, which is interesting when you compare it to the biblical account, because this is well within the time when Israel is established. It's just before the United Monarchy. So you might ask, well, why do we have this different group here controlling this port? Well, if you look in the Judges account, it talks about how Dor and its inhabitants were not conquered at the time of the conquest. So it makes sense if you've got these different peoples living in and controlling that particular area at that point in time, these Sea Peoples. So we have evidence of booming trade at that time based on the cargo of this certain ship that dated to the 11th century, Cargo M, it was called. It has remains from Cyprus, from Egypt, a broad trade area. So that was one of the cargoes. The other two cargoes were named Cargo L, Cargo L1, and Cargo L2. Now, these initially had been dated to the Persian period, but the new research, the new excavations revealed that they actually both date to the Iron Age, one of which dates to the late 9th to early 8th centuries BCE. And based on the remains that were found in this ship, the researchers postulated that we have a contraction of trade, that it's not as broad, we don't have as much material from far-flung places, and they posit that trade during this period, during the Israelite kingdom period, had contracted somewhat. And even this is interesting to speculate on with regards to the biblical account. This is during the divided kingdom period. So the late 9th, early 8th centuries, this is the time right before the reign of King Jeroboam. And you've got the, I think it's 2 Kings 14 account, where it talks about some of the woes in Israel and that there was no helper for Israel. Israel was in a lull period before Jeroboam comes along during the early to mid 8th century and things take off again. So that's kind of interesting to speculate on. With these cargoes in general, some other researchers have said we just don't have enough yet to say anything definitive. It's three cargoes, three ships. Like, you can only draw so much from these conclusions. But in any case, that's what we have from the cargo, the second ship cargo, the third ship, L2. This dated to the end of the 7th to start of the 6th centuries. And again, we have a swing to the other direction. It seems like based on the cargo contained within this ship, there was a broadening of the trade, of the destinations which were being visited, materials being picked up. And this would be during the Assyrian period, the period of Assyrian control of Tel Dor.
Great. Thank you. Now we're going to number seven. We're not actually going too far from Dor with this next discovery. And this is talking about the bronze making bronze production that was taking place at Alawat, and this is up in the northern Central Highlands territory of on the edge territory of ancient Manasseh. And this was very important because it dates the time period around King David, the end of Iron One, start of Iron 2A, and this the study was published in the Plus One journal by a team from University of Haifa, who've gone back to the site and are excavating the site and continue to excavate the site. However, most of the metal objects made from bronze came out of the drawer of Adam Zertal, who did work at the site previously. He's since died. But what's so important about this is the earliest evidence in the entire southern Levant that bronze making was taking place here. And this is different to bronze working, where you get the bronze, you import the bronze, and you make something out of it. No, bronze making means you are getting copper from somewhere, and you are procuring tin from somewhere, and then you are doing this sophisticated process to make bronze, and then you're going to be making bronze ingots or actually making items out of the bronze. And so just incredible, because this matches up perfectly with the time period of King David and his control over the region. I think what's also interesting is the fact that it's the evidence of where the bronze where the copper came from. They were able to determine the team that the copper came from two sites. They came from the Finan region in the direct south of the Dead Sea over in Edomite territory. And then it also came from Timnah, which is over 100 kilometers further south. They came from both of those sites. And only starting in the very early 10th century do you have both of these sites working together, evidence of incremental change that mirrored, paralleled at both sites, was found by Erez ben Yosef in Timnah, combining with the excavations at Kibbut Em and Nahas, the biggest mining facility in Finan. And they've shown there was a huge change where both of these, before this 10th century came along, both sites were operating with copper production, but they were both operating separately. They didn't share technology. 10th century comes around, boom, they're starting to share technology, indicating a single polity, one group of people over them. And then it is that copper then that winds up in this rinky-dink town, if I can call it that, not necessarily a very important, as we would see it, town. The copper's there, and then they're getting tin, and they're going to be producing bronze from this location. Where they get the tin from, still up for debate, but the best candidate so far is they're getting it all the way from the British Isles, from the area of Cornwall. We have evidence of ingots being found in shipwrecks off the coast of Haifa, just north of Dore, from an earlier period than this, and that was traced all the way back to Cornwall, the tin mines at Cornwall. And so it doesn't just speak to, hey, they knew how to do this, but also they knew how to procure both of these items from far distances across the Mediterranean. And it matches up archaeologically the time period around King David. Now, the researchers from Haifa University are a little more hesitant to say that it relates to the United Monarchy and the work of King David. Erez ben Yosef, who excavated Timnah and who works at the University of Tel Aviv University, he was far more firm with indicating that this is just another sign that points to the power from King David's time and the United Monarchy in Israel. So, number seven, we're calling it Davidic bronze at Alawat.
All right, number six. This was the discovery of a New Kingdom period tomb in Egypt. So this is the tomb of Thutmose II. So the New Kingdom period was the golden age of Egypt. This lasted from about 1550 BCE to 1050, 1070 BCE, so the second half of the second millennium BCE. This was the time of the Israelite enslavement, the time of the Exodus, whether you take the early or the late date Exodus. Either way, this was the kind, this was the spot to look for in terms of the Exodus. There are different views. I'm digressing already. But as far as the pharaohs of this period go, there are very few left to find, or tombs left to find. Probably the most famous tomb discovery was in the 1920s of Tutankhamun. Huge news, huge discovery. So the fact that another New Kingdom period tomb has been uncovered is huge news as well, although the pharaoh wasn't buried inside. This is a really funny scenario in which we already had the mummy of the pharaoh, we just didn't have his tomb. And in fact, this tomb of his was basically cleared out. So he had actually been reinterred at Deir el-Bahari, but his original tomb had been missing. So this wasn't a case of we've got a tomb and a mummy. It wasn't a case of we've got a tomb without a mummy. This is a case of we've got the mummy, but not his official original tomb. So just this year, the discovery was announced in Wadi Si, the discovery of his rock-cut tomb. It had all the hallmarks of the tomb of a pharaoh. It had the typical star map ceiling, typical friezes that they had cut around the tomb. And then notably within it, there were alabaster vessels, just fragments of them that hadn't been removed, which had the names of Thutmose the Second and his wife, his royal wife Hatshepsut. So there's a funny story. One of the British researchers, when he came out of the tomb, his wife was there waiting for him outside of the tomb. And this was just when the realization came of what they had found. He said he walked out and tears just started streaming from his eyes. It's like one of these really big discoveries. And so what we have here is the tomb of Thutmose the Second. The reason why it had been cleared out and he had been reburied elsewhere was initially thought to be to protect it from robbers, to protect from grave robbery. It seems like now that this original tomb actually was being flooded very early on after its construction. So Thutmose the Second, his body was reinterred elsewhere. Soon after, like very soon after he had been buried, there was a waterfall in the area, evidently. So this tomb was going to fall apart due to flooding. So it's a broadly empty tomb, but it's a tomb of a New Kingdom period pharaoh as well. And I have to make mention a little bit of where I see this in the Exodus account. So with the typical early Exodus reconstruction here, these models have Hatshepsut as the Pharaoh's daughter of Exodus 2. And so Thutmose the Second, he would be the Pharaoh husband of the Pharaoh's daughter we read about in the Bible. Some people also have him as the Pharaoh under whom Moses was born and set adrift. Personally, I think that was Thutmose the First. In any case, that we're right in the ballpark here, right in that Exodus 2 period in which you have these events being described, which I think you have the best fit of these events being described, with Thutmose the Second, Hatshepsut as his royal wife, the Pharaoh's daughter, and then Moses coming on the scene. So from that standpoint, from an early Exodus position, this is a really significant pharaoh and a really significant find, no matter how you slice it.
Great.
Over to you.
Thank you. We're going to head back to the late 7th, early 6th century BCE, talking about Josiah's time with this next discovery. This was made by the Temple Mount Sifting Project, where they are going through the dumps that are from the Temple Mount that were illegally dumped there in the 90s. They're still working through all of that, and they discovered a seal impression belonging to one Yedaya, son of Asiyahu. And this name might not be too familiar to everybody, as it wasn't to when most of these sealings are discovered. Either it's a really famous biblical personality, or it brings you back to the Bible, and there's a frantic search to see if these names are used in the text. And this one was at least the last name of this individual. So based on the writing style of it, it would be dated to the late 7th, early 6th century BCE, around the time of King Josiah. And this was used not to seal a document, but maybe a bag or a sack or the top of a vessel that was covered with a bag or something like that. And it has the first and last name of some official. And so we have lots of these that have been found throughout excavations in Jerusalem. Famous biblical personalities, Hezekiah, Isaiah, people mentioned in the book of Jeremiah, many of them, and even during people from Josiah's time as well. So this one fits into that same period. Now, it's very hard to be definitive. Is this person from the Bible? We do have somebody with this last name. Asiyahu is mentioned during the time period of Josiah. He's one of the guys that when the copy of the law was found in the temple, there was a message that was going to be sent to Huldah the prophet, to prophetess, to see what should we do about this situation. One of these guys, these servants of Josiah, was Asiyahu. And now we have a son of Asiyahu mentioned. So if it would be nice to say 100% this is the same guy, it does match this guy's name. He is an official in the court of Josiah. Paleography matches this same time period. It was found in Jerusalem. And so there's lots of boxes that you would tick that this is the same guy from the biblical period from the time of Josiah, but we don't know. But anytime there is a new seal impression found in Jerusalem with a probable match to the Bible, it's definitely going to make our top 10. So you're going to do number 4 and number 3. And then I'm going to jump in on number 2 and number 1. So off you go.
That's right. Okay, so for number 4 discovery, this was another one found in wet sifting from Jerusalem. This was found during the excavations happening on the southwest corner of the Temple Mount, being led by Dr. Ayala Zilberstein. This is a small Assyrian cuneiform inscription about 2.5 centimeters wide. I have to make sure I get this right. It is the first temple period Neo-Assyrian inscription ever found in Jerusalem. So I have to get that right because there are other Assyro-Akkadian inscriptions from before the first temple period. So it's not the first, it's like the first temple period inscription. Right. So a couple of which were found on our excavations in past years from the Bronze Age. But this is from the First Temple period, the Iron Age. This, if I can back up a little bit, these are excavations that are happening on the southwest corner of the Temple Mount complex.
So just so I can butt in here, we'll clarify. Southwest corner outside the Temple Mount complex.
Outside the temple.
Just in case anyone thinks we're digging in Al-Aqsa.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody is. No. So these are excavations happening at the northern end of the pilgrimage road, or with the aims of finding the northern continuation of the pilgrimage road. They are down very impressively deep. If you've been through the Davidson Center and seeing their excavations there. We were given a personal tour by one of the directors there. Really interesting area. In any case, you have these later period fills in which this Assyrian inscription was found. So it wasn't found in its original stratified First Temple period context. It was found together with later period remains. So dating of this inscription makes it a little bit harder. You have to rely a lot more, say, on paleographical analyses, analysis of the writing style. So based on that, it dates to the 8th to 7th centuries BCE, and it represents a letter, a very fragmentary letter sent from Assyria to Jerusalem demanding a late payment of tribute. Basically, Jerusalem, the king there, an unnamed king, he's not named on this this fragment, so we have to be a little bit speculative as to who it could be. This unnamed king had failed to make a tribute payment on time, and so this fragment is demanding this payment by the first of Av. So based on this context, we know that this was a time of Assyrian power and hegemony. We have the northern kingdom of Israel already having been conquered at this point, and they start to tighten the grip on the southern kingdom of Judah. So at the end of the 8th century, you have the time of King Hezekiah, and you have his famous refusal to pay tribute to the kings of Assyria in 2 Kings 18. So there's a really good possibility, I think, and this is what the researchers posit. The Assyriologists who studied this, Dr. Philip Vukosavovic, Dr. Anat Cohen-Weinberger, and Dr. Peter Zilberg, they posit potentially a link with Hezekiah and the well-known account, biblically and archaeologically, of him butting heads with Sennacherib. The Bible talks about him not submitting to the yoke of Assyria. He wasn't paying the tribute they felt he should have been. And so this big invasion happens. So this could date to his time period, or based on the broadness of the dating, it could date to a little bit later, perhaps the time of King Manasseh. We have, especially in the Second Chronicles account, I think it's Second Chronicles 33, something like this, his interactions back and forth, falling out of favor with Assyria, and then being taken away prisoner. So whatever the case is, we have this little inscription showing some of the back and forth that was happening at that time between these positions of power between Jerusalem and mighty Assyria. When you look at the makeup of this inscription, the petrographic analyses of this inscription show that it wasn't local, unsurprising. It comes from the Tigris Basin, so way off in Mesopotamia. We don't have an exact location. Studies are ongoing as to where exactly this clay came from, where this letter would have been sent from, one of these big Assyrian power centers. So the researchers, the Assyriologists who studied and published this item, they believe it was part of a certain type of Assyrian royal seal, in which you have a clay seal containing a longer and more elaborate letter, but the seal contains an abbreviation of the contents of the letter, basically an abstract, and right. Then you have the paper inside, a very demanding abstract. So whatever the case is, and there's been some debate already about what this is, what it represents, it's an incredible find. Dr. Vukosavovic, he said of this find that it was excitement on a level I can't remember ever experiencing. So it's a cool moment to get into the heads of these people who are excavating these things, studying these things. Yeah. This is a Jerusalem Assyriologist, and this is the first Assyrian inscription from the first temple period. So how can you be anything but just blown away and excited by it? So.
It's you know, this is a horrible analogy, but it's like, you know, people that play golf all their life and then they finally get a hole in one. And it's like, you know, the euphoria over that.
Right.
And so, you know, archaeology is such a laborious business. And the archaeologists have to love walls and stratigraphy or else they wouldn't even do it. But then to have the finds that are made in the process, nobody in archaeology goes to find this. They're trying to find who lived here, what do their buildings look like, what was the larger, you know, everyday life like, which powers are involved. And then these amazing discoveries happen in a moment. And they're always unexpected. And so, yeah, it does give you chills, and I'm very happy for him. Very, let's say, emotional, in the right way, just got a lot of gusto behind him. And so I can just imagine the emotion that came for him with that. Okay.
I hope I pronounced his name correctly as well.
You did a really good job. Like, it's up there. I've got a difficult last name, but I think his is harder than mine. And I think he did a really good job there. Yeah. So that is the hardest thing in that video was pronouncing his last name. Mm-hmm. So well done. Okay, number three. Let's do it.
Number three, the redating of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So this was a big story that came out a few months ago. So Dead Sea Scrolls, one of the most, if not the most significant trove discovery. It's hard to call it a single item. One of the most significant in biblical archaeology ever. So this is a corpus of scrolls dating back to between the 2nd century BCE to 2nd century CE. This corpus that began to be found from the 1940s onwards in the Judean desert, particularly at Qumran, containing thousands of manuscripts, fragments, many, many biblical texts in fragmentary or even near complete form. So this is a really important trove. It's been studied and restudied over the decades. This is a discovery that one researcher said it'll have extraordinary consequences on our field. And I don't think it can be underestimated. So this new AI-developed program called Enoch was basically trained on analyzing 24 manuscripts that have been securely carbon dated and then basically turned loose on these other manuscripts to see if it can provide more accurate dating for them. So again, there are thousands of these manuscripts. Carbon dating is a very clunky, very time-consuming, extremely expensive, and partly destructive method of dating things. We can't date all these thousands of manuscripts. So typically for dating them, researchers have relied on more paleographical approaches, more laborious, intense analyzing of writing styles, and okay, this probably fits with this certain period or that certain period better. But even there, it's easy to miss little edges of ink, little spots here and there. So if you've got a computer program, that can potentially pick things up in a lot more detail and a lot more resolution. So again, this program called Enoch that was developed by these researchers, they trained it on 24 securely dated manuscripts and then set it loose on these other manuscripts to see what dates it provided. And then those manuscripts were then retroactively reanalyzed to see how accurate these dates would have been, post hoc evaluation. So in the round, what this program showed is that these manuscripts should be dated earlier than the general dates given to them. So a large body of these manuscripts seem to date to the 3rd century BCE, 3rd century, 2nd century BCE, even into the 4th century BCE, much earlier than the researchers anticipated. Some of the manuscripts, so a part of the Book of Samuel, part of Jeremiah, they were dated back into the 4th century. The Book of Ecclesiastes, some a manuscript relating to that was dated even earlier within the 3rd century. So the Book of Ecclesiastes has been typically very late dated by more minimalist leaning scholars. So even that alone, pushing it back and pushing this particular copy of it back into the early 3rd century is much, much earlier and really challenges some of these late date composition hypotheses. Now, the most notable manuscript that has come out of all of this, the dating for it is 4Q114. This is a section of the latter part of Daniel, the part from chapters 8 to 11 that talk about the that prophesy about the Seleucid Empire, particularly the reign of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. In Very high resolution. Like there's no debate as to what the section of scripture is talking about. Now, on the traditional the traditional interpretation analysis, Daniel is a 6th century BCE prophet. He's on the scene in the 6th century, the time of Nebuchadnezzar and onwards, start of the Persian Empire, and he's prophesying all of these things. You have this passage of scripture which describes with such resolution the 3rd on into the 2nd centuries BCE, the Seleucid time period culminating in Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes, that most people say that this section of scripture must have been written much later on, must have been added much later on, certainly from 160 onwards, something like this, from the 160s onwards, because you have, during the 160s, you have Antiochus Epiphanes on the scene, fulfilling a lot of what is described in Daniel, attributed to him in Jerusalem, the kind of actions he's doing in Jerusalem, the pollution of the temple, and then you have the Maccabean response to that. So most critical scholars say, well, that section was written later on. This new analysis of this fragment from this section of text was dated to a window. So all of these dates provided by Enoch are windows of time. They're not like, here it is exactly at this point in time. So it gave a window from 230 BCE to 160. So already this whole window is much earlier than people expected. So you can still try and make the case that, well, the window includes the 160s, and so perhaps it was written right at the end of this window. But even still, like, this is a copy of a manuscript that has somehow made it out into the Judean desert in the bounds of this more esoteric community, more of a pariah-like community. So it takes some time for work to be authored and to make it out into these communities. So already you're straining credulity with trying to fit that in. So the other option is maybe these works really were prophetic. Like, it has prompted some of this pushback. There was one epigrapher that came out and said, well, we know the dates Enoch is giving us are wrong because this work cannot date so early.
Right.
Like, it has to post-date this period. Whereas I think a lot of believers...
great scientific point of view there.
Yeah, we'll see this. And... be really interested by it as substantiating an earlier written text. So it's interesting to see how this one is playing out and how people are dealing with these new interpretations. But anytime you've got these biblical texts, and not just some tiny little fragment, but like this big body of texts with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and all of a sudden we see evidence that actually a good body of it should be pushed even earlier, this is going to be really consequential for future study of these texts, debates about times of composition. I'll just quickly mention as well, so there are two main writing styles that we have there, the Hasmonean script and the Herodian script. And so what this textual analysis has done is said that actually these both move back even earlier than researchers had proposed. And actually, there's even some overlap that hadn't been appreciated between the Hasmonean and Herodian scripts. So this, just in general, is kind of upending these assumptions, these earlier studies that have gone into the manuscript. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But that's number 3.
Very cool. Thanks for explaining that. I think it's very important for people to understand that, because it can be a little bit convoluted for us outsiders. Okay, so I'm doing number 2 and number 1. I won't take forever on these because we have done programs on both of them, and we've written substantial articles. As most of these discoveries that we're talking about, they've got substantial articles and about them, and we'll put them in our show notes for you today. Number two is this amazing dam that was discovered in Jerusalem that dates to the very end of the 9th, start of the 8th century BCE, based on new carbon dates. So this is incredible. We're right in the middle, let's say, halfway between David and the destruction of Jerusalem at the hands of the Babylonians. And you have this huge dam wall in the very southern part of the city of David that we've known about. People have been excavating this. It's been drawn on maps from about 100 years, just the very top of it. But now the excavators at the Antiquities Authority have been excavating this area since 2023. Nachshon Zanton I think Berkman is his last name. Berko, Itamar Berko. They've been excavating it, and they've gone to all the way to the bottom of this wall, and they've found the plaster on the very base of it. And then they got in a team from the Weizmann Institute, Elisabetta Barreto and Joanna Regev, to take some carbon samples from the dam wall itself, from the very upper portion of the dam wall itself. And they came back with these dates that are just what you want when you take carbon dates. Not like this huge variation, but all four of them dating to plus or minus 10 years or so around 800. So it's giving us a very definitive date for this dam wall to 800 BC, which is probably, I mean, in my view, this dam belonged to Hezekiah, because we know that Hezekiah builds a tunnel and goes through the city of David, underneath the city of David, to protect the water supply of Jerusalem from Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, and he needs a dam, right? It says he builds a reservoir. And then this is 100 years before Hezekiah. So we already have a huge, colossal construction in Jerusalem of a water reservoir 100 years before him. So this is, it's huge, and so it makes our number two for sure. There has been debate now, and there's going to be more debate as to how this dam fit into the development of Jerusalem. You have the more minimalist camp that think that only the Eastern Hill, this where the Gihon Spring is, and this dam's at the very southern portion of that, the Eastern Hill, the City of David, and then the development of it and the spread of the city didn't happen across to the other hill, the Western Hill. It didn't happen till the time of Hezekiah. But here we have a dam that goes from one hill to the other 100 years before Hezekiah. So expansion of Jerusalem must have happened earlier. Now, once you dig a little bit deeper about into this dam, and this is what Nachshon Zanton has done, as to what is this, the name of this reservoir in historical documents, there's a couple of different thoughts out there that this could be the Siloam Pool, mentioned in John 9 and other places from the time of Jesus, so 2,000 years ago, or it could be Solomon's Pool, that is written by Josephus from around the same time period, and that the Siloam Pool is somewhere else. And so you have a series of archaeologists now coming up with different ideas of what was this pool during the time 2,000 years ago. Well, hang on a second. It dates at least 800 years before then. And so what we've done is, with our article, is put a plausible case that, you know, the dating of this to 800 BC is very important, but the samples are taken at the very top, and so perhaps this was an even earlier dam that was that actually comes from the time period of Solomon, and then it was reused. Now, we don't have 100% knock-it-out-of-the-park proof. For this dating, you would have to rip out the whole dam wall, or at least take a big trench right down the middle of it and get some samples from the very base of the dam wall to see when it was first constructed. However, it's the dam itself is connected to a canal that goes from the city of David along the eastern side of the city, and it empties into this. And that the very starting of this canal has been dated by some as early as the Middle Bronze Age, others dating it to the time period of the United Monarchy, to the time period of Solomon. We've had initial researchers of Jerusalem talk about this canal definitely dating to a peaceful period during the time of Solomon. Like, they're so definitive about this. And then it eventually flows down into a pool called, most likely, Solomon's Pool. Now, the name Solomon's Pool comes from 1,000 years after Solomon. So we have to read in a little to that. However, I think there's a good case that we have that this pool could date all the way back to his time. We have other biblical evidence of from the book of Ecclesiastes that talks about Solomon building building pools, building reservoirs. We also have the famous King's Garden that Solomon's writing about in the Song of Songs, which in the same issue we have your article summarizing Gabriel Barkai's work to show that the Song of Songs is a 10th century production. And so if he's writing about pools that he built, where are those pools from the 10th century? Well, this could be one of them. So this one, in its own right, to date this massive reservoir to 100 years before Hezekiah is incredible. And well done to the teams from the IAA and the Wiseman Institute for bringing this new information to us. But I think the jury is still out as to when its original construction might have taken place. Any comments from you? Just there nodding.
I think that makes a lot of sense, though, about an earlier phase. Like in our recent excavations, we've been working through all these different waterworks from the Herodian time period. So, okay, we're talking later, but there's nothing new under the sun. And so with these waterworks, you've got these multiple phases, like even compressed within a short space of time, you've got replastering, right, relayering, replastering, relayering, and then they fall out of use. And that just within a short space of time. So it would seem prodigious to me to have this huge dam built and finished and everything done at a singular point in time, and then nothing else happened to it until however much later. It seems like there would logically be earlier phases that eventually resulted in it being what we see to this day.
So people can look up that and read it and come to their own opinion on that. But regardless, it's still an amazing discovery of this huge reservoir. Now, number one, this is our number one. And this refers to the scene of Jerusalem that has been identified in King Sennacherib's palace in Nineveh with Hezekiah himself included. So this is based on the research that was presented at the American Schools for Overseas Research Conference in Boston last year, well, in 2024, actually. And his presentation was finally written up in a peer-reviewed journal that the University of Chicago produces. And what is so amazing, and we'll leave show notes, links to these in the show notes of it. And what Stephen Compton does is he brings to bear research over the past 170 years when Nineveh was actually first excavated, and several archaeologists have gone back there and drawn the walls, photographed the walls, and come to try and discern what is on these massive wall reliefs. Now, sometimes there's an epigraph, a name of a city or something that is associated with the reliefs. This happens in the famous Room 36 of Sennacherib's palace, where you have the takeover of Lachish, the second city of Judah from this same time period, and which is displayed now in the British Museum. But other times you don't have epigraphs or a written explainer of what the scene depicts. And in the throne room, you have very few of these. There are some, but a lot of them are hard to read, or they're broken or only partial. So it's very hard to put it together. However, before these, a lot of these scenes were drawn 170 years ago by Austin Henry Layard, his team, a British archaeologist. And so we have what many of the original panels look like. And this hall is over 50 meters long. It's the largest room ever discovered in any of the Assyrian palaces, whether it's in Khorsabad, Nimrud, or Nineveh. It's huge. It's prime real estate, as Stephen Compton says, that you're going to depict, you know, things that are very important to you. And so what's important with this is that the biblical narrative for Hezekiah's time and the confrontation with Sennacherib is one of the most attested archaeological events already. and we've got it written in the Bible in three accounts, in Chronicles, Kings, and Isaiah. Several chapters in Isaiah are written about this failed campaign to take over all of Judah. It talks about him coming down Sennacherib with his army, and he is trying to, he takes over the Phoenicia first, then he takes over the Philistine plain second. This is what his annals say, his written documents, and the biblical text also mentions this in the book of Isaiah. And then he finally sets his sight on Judah, and he takes over 46 walled cities, but he can't take Jerusalem. And there's this miraculous event where 185,000 Assyrian soldiers are put to death in the middle of the night, and Hezekiah survives, and Judah survives. Basically, Jerusalem survives. And so this is a big event in the Bible, but it's also a big event in Sennacherib's annals. I mean, he writes about this event in numerous texts. And so when researchers come along to the throne room, then to see what's depicted on the walls, there are some that have said, well, maybe this picture of us that is utterly unique, that's 3 meters high, over 2 meters wide, that depicts an empty city with one guy standing atop the tallest tower, holding onto a flag or a standard. There are some, starting with Christoph Erlinger back in the early 2000s, that said that this could be Jerusalem, that this could be a scene of Jerusalem from 2,700 years ago. And he said, Jerusalem's my best guess. I don't have 100% positive proof, but I think that it's the best concept to work from. Now, Stephen Compton has built on that research of Erlinger, and has come up with another couple of reasons of why it should be Jerusalem, based on Sennacherib's annals and based on what you can see in the picture. And so Sennacherib writes in his third campaign that he's coming down to Judah, coming down to the Western Mediterranean, takes over Phoenicia, then Philistia, and then Judah. And so if you look at the panels that precede this in chronological order, you do have Phoenician scene. You do have a scene on the plains of Philistia with the taking of Eltika, or the war that takes place, the battle that takes place in Philistine territory. And then you have this city. Now, some of the panels in between are missing, so we don't know exactly what happened in between. But then when you get to this scene, it is utterly unique in all Assyrian wall reliefs. I've spent the past couple of weeks just going through every drawing of every wall relief in every Assyrian palace, and it is utterly unique. In all other examples, you have, you know, an enemy city with people throwing stones or arrows or anything else than just a lone figure holding onto a standard. This is the only one that we've got where he's holding onto a standard. And the Assyrian documents talk about kings and their standards. It's an emblem of royal authority. So you have a king standing here. And then you look at the architecture. And this is what Stephen Compton does in a really dramatic way. He puts it together with Lachish, and he puts it together with another wall relief that was unnamed, but researchers prior to him, potentially it could be a picture of Gath. And on that you have what's called double corbelled battlement that goes on top of a tower, a defensive tower, where there's two platforms that extend out from each other. And you have this same architecture existing on the Jerusalem one, Lachish, definitely Judean, and then Gath, which had a phase of Judean rule based on the pottery and based on the Bible. The Bible says that. And then you have this one. So it's a Judean city as well. There's other elements of it that he draws attention to. The very shape of the flag itself, he talks about this being a Ness symbol, which is the Hebrew word for the banner that is described in the Bible when they're holding up their flags. And the same word is used for a sail as well in the Bible. The book of Ezekiel talks about that. And we have depictions of sails from this same time period, and they have a single pole that's upright, vertical, and then at the very top, you have a horizontal beam, and then the sail comes down from that, which is very different to other sails. And this is what you see on this the style of the shape of this banner as well. So it's a Judean banner. It's the Ness as well. And then you just think of Sennacherib's annals, what he writes. Sennacherib writes about Hezekiah in his caging up Hezekiah, sorry, besieging Hezekiah in Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. And that's what you have. You have a king, no one around him, and like a bird in a cage inside this royal city. Now, people would say, well, why, if he didn't destroy Jerusalem, why, you know, put it in his throne room? I mean, you have to make an account. If you're a king, this event happens, you have to make some type of accounting of it. And if he, you'd say, okay, why is he putting it in his throne room? Well, why is he writing about this event over and over and over again in his annals? We have 101 references at least of King Hezekiah being named explicitly in archaeological documents that have come up with from Assyria through excavation over the years. This is the surviving remains of Hezekiah. Like, he had Hezekiah on the brain in his written annals. So it also makes sense to have Hezekiah in his throne room. And even in the entrances to the throne room, this is not something that Compton brings out in his paper, but I wish perhaps he did, that you have mentions of Hezekiah and other kings. But when there's a less detailed account, there's Hezekiah and a couple others that are mentioned. Not like the full annals is only mentioned in one of the accounts of the doorways to this throne room. So you have a lot of evidence that points to this being Jerusalem. And which I think is remarkable, the timing of this. I mean, already this was the most testified event in archaeology and the Bible, putting it together, corroborated event. And then to have a picture of Jerusalem from 2,700 years ago that shows what had happened. I mean, if you even look in the book of Isaiah, we have an article about this. It talks about how that Sennacherib, that Hezekiah was going to, or that Isaiah the prophet is warning him, don't go and trust the Egyptians. We know archaeologically, based on epigraphic evidence, you've written an article about this, that there's a heavy Egyptian influence here in Judah at this same time period. And Isaiah says, don't go to Egypt, don't trust in them. If you do trust in them, it's basically going to end up that you're going to be standing on the top of a hill, holding on to a Ness, holding on to a standard. And that's this picture as well. So I think it's there's not many people have reported on this yet. It's only just breaking right now over the past 2 weeks. So I hope there's some chatter about it, because if somebody wants to get a visual depiction of Jerusalem from this time period, we can have it. I mean, the next picture of Jerusalem comes from the Byzantine period, the Madeba map. People pore over that to try and get insights as to what Jerusalem looked like in the Byzantine period. And here we have an image of Jerusalem from the time of the biblical kings. Certainly, I think this warrants a number one for us.
If I can add, I think it is hard to overstate the importance of this, the significance of it. It's really an incredible discovery when you can actually picture something. When you have a pictorial display of something like this, for it to be the earliest picture of Jerusalem ever, for it to be a picture of a king, I think, as you said, some have posited this in the past already as Jerusalem, notably Erlinger in the year 2000, then in 2003 in a book. But from what I gather, that was more of a tentative association. And the way Compton has come at this, like initially, he wasn't even looking for Jerusalem. Like the right. way he got to this route is really interesting. And in my mind, it proves that this is Jerusalem as much as you can prove it to be Jerusalem. So rather than it being, well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I think this really is the cherry on top. And Compton himself mentions like that he stands on the shoulders of giants like Erlinger right. in making these associations. So already it's been put forward in the past, but I think this new research rightfully has to go at number one for our discovery of 2025. A discovery as significant as this and relating to a king, A lot of people won't realize that now we have nearly half a dozen potential portrayals of Kings of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you know, on the basis of this being Hezekiah, this would go along then with the Black Obelisk portraying King Jehu. This would go with the Esarhaddon stela, which almost certainly, I believe, portrays Manasseh with the hooks in his face. You have a portrayal of King Jehoash from Kuntalet Ajrud on some plaster remains. So that has been identified as possibly being King Jehoash. And then you've got the little head discovery from Abu Bet Maha, which is possibly King Ahab, or perhaps a surrounding regional king. So not only can you read about these things, you can see them.
Right.
Like, you can see Jerusalem, you can see these kings. So I think it's a really astounding discovery. It needs to be talked about more, I think.
I think we'll talk about it more as well. I mean, there's been a little bit of pushback from a couple online, and that I think we're going to address some of these issues. One's positing that it's Ekron, which even Erlinger kind of puts to the side, say it can't be Ekron. It doesn't match the reliefs, it doesn't match the annals. The geography is different in this. You can see it's a mountainous region. Ekron isn't on a mountainous region. As well, we have a depiction of Ekron from 10 years earlier from Khorsabad, I believe it is, from Sargon II. The city looks totally different to the depiction here. But definitely, when you're making a bold claim, there are people that are going to be like, well, is it really? How sure can we be? And I love that. I mean, you've got to, because there've been so many discoveries that have come out in the past, even in the realm of biblical archaeology sometimes, where we think it's this, we think it's this. And then, you know, maybe over time this happens rarely, but maybe that first designation might change a little bit based on more evidence. And so if people come to it with a slightly skeptical mind, definitely those issues need to be addressed and talked about. But then you also just have to look at the overwhelming weight of evidence and not be blinded to it not being Jerusalem or not being what the Bible says because of another preconceived bias in there. So fascinating discovery. That's our whole top 10. This took us so much longer than we anticipated, but people can't fault us for liking what we do. I mean, you want to have the physiologists being great at loving it. You want to have sports stars loving their sport. You want to have archaeologists loving archaeology, and scientists loving their specific field. And then hopefully people can kind of live off that passion as well. So that's our top 10. Show notes are down below. Don't forget to subscribe to our magazine, where you would have read about a lot of these discoveries already. It's absolutely free. Thanks very much, Chris, for working a long day there in Jerusalem and going ahead and taking your time with me.
Pleasure as always. We look forward to what this year will bring.
Yep. Time will tell. Have a good day.
You too.